I'm Christopher Lighton with the cult poet who's just won the very mainstream National Book Award. Keith Waldrop makes spare collages of words and phrases. He could remind you of those gorgeous torn paper collages of the painter Robert Motherwell. He could also remind you of Samuel Beckett's stark minimalism. He reminds me of Thelonious Monk, who bent phrasing and rhythm and harmony in jazz. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, in our series, Whose Words These Are, on the practice of poetry today. Keith Waldrop is our first avant-gardist, our first Kansan, too, though he's been a teacher for many years now at Brown. He's an experimentalist, and his meanings don't hit you on a first reading or a fifth reading. He makes statements here and there, but his poetry, he has said, is about having nothing to say and saying it, which sounds a lot like Beckett. Keith Waldrop, congratulations on the National Book Award. You have said, what I'm after is closer to music than philosophy or information in that sense.
That's true.
From this new book, Transcendental Studies, would you read some, please, and show us what you're doing?
All right, let's see. Plurality of worlds. And each inhabitant resolves, and I with my various processes, I stumble, I revolve. As one sees in the desert, water welling, always distant, forever unapproachable. A view of the chase from the battlements, to see something, anything, I always step back, and then, where am I? Distant, unapproachable, my name, Jericho. Absurdly, I mean out of tune, and forgetfulness, deceit, error. For us to grow old, the moon must rise. From invisible fire, flames leap into view, a dream of bodily heaven. Hot colors, subtle nuances, motives recast in sight after sight, figures absorbed by a plethora of drapery. I must remove all this. Evening chill, an impression of transparency, your presence. Remove it all without letting anything go. I was born in December, and things always seem to come at me like January. The fifth, the third bird in the tree this morning. Joy, laughter, lamentation, it's like a map. Minuet, waltz, 90% too dark to see. Let me think now. Roads, tombs, temples, I could list my friends. What will I forget next? Light analyzed by dusk, and then the specters still there. A painterly softening, almost heraldic poses. Long, narrow slits of light, dark bars against bright ground or straight-line borders peculiarly oriented. Looking one way, everything is loss. The other direction, nothing to lose. In a crystal I glimpse maybe my waking state, my soul's fictitious body, think. My health, the world's long, lingering illness. Pain, hot, cold, mere contact, crude sensory modalities, these remain after destruction of the sensory cortex. Pain, shock waves, feathery feet of barnacles, it does not reach us, the sun's bottomless profundo. Things age, and when old enough, no longer able to resist, become animate, unable to stay free of life. What remains of ancient rites? Grammar. I would never give up anything I have in return for mere certainty.
I'm so glad you read that. It has so many memorable phrases. A plethora of drapery, an impression of transparency, the world's long lingering illness. But I don't know how to connect them.
Well, that's why it's a plurality of worlds.
Okay.
There's also, by the way, a very bad joke in there that my name is Jericho, like wall drop.
Ah, fit the battle of.
Terrible joke.
And then that final line, I would never give up anything I have for mere certainty.
Right. It seems to me that that's what I've always been told in various classes, whether in philosophy or religion or whatever, you know, we have certainty. And the idea even of assuming that you could find certainty seems to me absurd. I mean, what do we know for certain? We don't know anything for certain. We don't even know for certain that we don't know for certain.
So there is something of a philosophical agenda here.
Well, there are certain things I assume when I start writing, and I hope by writing I'll find out other things. I don't start out writing thinking what I want to get across is, and then there's this lesson. No, it's just I write. I just hope something will come out of it. And it doesn't always. And much that I write goes into the trash eventually.
How do you do it? And would you call this a collage poem?
This poem was exactly a collage poem. In fact, this book is mainly collage, not all of it, but mainly. I was at some point, I had to become the director of the graduate writing program. And it wasn't that it was a difficult thing to do, but it was endless. And after some months, I realized that I wasn't writing anything. Hmm. And I decided I would do some collage poems. And I brought up a batch of books, all prose books, by the way, no verse, no poetry. And I stacked them on the dining room table. And to write a poem, I would take three of the books of three different kinds. I would have one novel, usually a book of psychology or science or something, and then some third one, depending on what was around. Hmm. And I would start opening them and getting phrases out, sort of at random, but not, you know, going to page so-and-so and such a line, but simply opening and my eyes might go down and I'd light on a phrase and I'd put it in it. I didn't spend a great deal of time doing it, but I would put these phrases down, going from one book to another, and in the three books I would make one stanza, let's say of four lines or so. Then I would do it again and get another stanza of four lines, and when I had enough that I thought, it's getting, you know, I'm tired of doing this. It might be a page, it might be a couple pages, not more than two or three. I would then, I was writing this by hand, I would take it upstairs to type, and I would retype these stanzas in alphabetical order.
Hmm.
And then I would, the next time I would start over and I would have a stand maybe of six lines or again four lines, whatever. And eventually, in a very, in a month or so, I had a book of poems. Now, and I arranged them alphabetically by title. I forget how I put the titles on. They don't necessarily have much to do with the poem. But you understand, in retyping them and then reading over them, I'm an endless reviser. no matter what I read of mine, I mean, sometimes of other people's. If I didn't like a line or a word, I could throw it out, I could change it, I could add something. Because it wasn't that I was trying to figure out something about collage, I was trying to find poems.
Hmm.
And the poem I read was one of those poems.
It sounds like a kind of quilting with other people's phrases and then and then reshaping.
Yes, but also the phrases that I was using were very short and put in connection with other phrases. I just can't imagine anybody, even if they knew what books I took them out of, they would have a hard time finding them.
Would they find any of those phrases intact, like things come at me like January?
Probably not. That sounds like, I mean, I was born in December after all. And this may be that's something I added.
What does poetic form, what does beauty, what does rhythm, rhyme, meter have to do with it?
Well, the sound in general has a great deal to do with it because that's what I go by. If a stanza sounds right, then at the moment it is right, no matter what it means or what it doesn't mean or whatever. If I don't understand it, nevertheless, if it sounds right, then it is right. And
that's what Duke Ellington said. If it sounds good, it is good.
That's right. I did three volumes, which are the three volumes that are in here, and they were accepted by a very small publisher up in Vermont, who got out the first volume, which is the first part of this book, and then got ill and she couldn't do the second and third. I sent them around. Nobody was interested in them at all. And I just sort of put them aside. At some point, a friend in France who had read some wanted to publish the second volume in French. And a woman who had translated some of my things before and who was a wonderful translator said she would translate them, that book. And I got a letter later from her saying what she had realized that the stanzas in each poem were alphabetical. And she said, well, I'll try to keep that alphabetical, but that's sort of maybe a little difficult. And I wrote back immediately, by no means do this. Translate each stanza as it would be the best way that stanza would be translated, and then rearrange them alphabetically. And this terrorized her. She just couldn't do this.
What does that say about the meaning or non-meaning?
Well,
in the
now
game?
Wait a minute. The point is, I happened to be passing through Paris, and I showed her that it was possible to do this, and it was published. As far as meaning goes, I see as much meaning in one version as the other. It's probably a different meaning. In some ways, I prefer the French. It's but meaning, as far as the message, what is said in it, I trust that something will be said, but I'm not very interested making it explicit. It's not what I write for. I write for the sound and the tone of things.
Mm.
And in fact, back in my mind somewhere from the minute I began to write poetry, I thought, if I really write this so that it sounds right, I will learn something from it that I didn't know.
Hmm.
So it isn't that I'm trying to teach something, I'm trying to learn something.
May I say that the book itself is a thing of beauty, with a cover using a collage by the late, great Robert Motherwell, a painter. I know his collages. They are excruciatingly gorgeous.
They're beautiful, yes.
Using all kinds of fancy French artist papers, wrappers, Gauloise packages. And in the variations of his collages, you can see him trying one against another and changing it or varying it. It sounds a great deal like your process.
Yeah. No, I was very much influenced by him. By his work. I didn't know him. I didn't know most of his work. But this particular exhibit that I saw of the Gauloise works just stunned me and had a great deal to do with the way I thought from then on of collage.
Would you read another one? Maybe one of the many poems that has clouds in it. There's a beauty on page 49.
Okay, it doesn't have a title. It's the last poem of the first of the three books in this trilogy. And the title of the whole first book is Shipwreck in Haven, which every time it gets mentioned anywhere, it's always a misprint and makes it Shipwreck in Heaven, which is terrible. Anyway, here is the poem. This is in three-line free verse stanzas. Behind and above, I saw then everything that was happening on earth and can describe the hum of clouds. Why are you screaming? East of the sycamore is the other world. Look, the same road, lisp and rustle. At length you may come to no decision, straight as a die, ample time for dancing between acts. I am relieved. The sycamore is healthy. At my death, I will go to it. Not into it, but someday, if sufficiently sensitive, you may spot me, in the guise of child or dwarf, perhaps, leaning against the trunk like a fallen branch. We are talking with rhyme and reason, an art of shading, smooth gradation of loud and soft, velocity distributed. Self-love, seeking an object, splits us in two.
Go back to the sort of boast or claim at the start of that poem about having seen everything and being able to describe the hum of clouds.
The hum of clouds, yes. Behind and above, I saw then everything that was happening on earth and can describe the hum of clouds. That's obviously not true, but...
what are you up to there?
I have no idea. I mean, if somebody said, all right, let's see you do it, I would be out of luck. I mean, it isn't something that anybody could do.
Keith Waldrop, would you take us back to Kansas in the 1930s and 40s? That was Bob Dole country. You were born most of 10 years later than he in Emporia, Kansas, in the heyday of the Emporia Gazette and its famous editor, William Allen White.
Yeah.
Who were you there, and what was the poetry of your boyhood?
As a child, I read mainly comic books and the Bible. I must have read some poems, but I don't remember exactly what.
Who told you you could be a poet, or that you had to be a poet?
Nobody told me I could be a poet. Nobody in my family was ever a poet. My father read Shakespeare, but he didn't write, and my mother read only the Bible. There was nobody ever in my family who was a poet or a writer or anything of the sort.
Recount the plunge into poetry. How did that happen?
Well, in high school I was reading mostly plays, but also I read Paradise Lost. I read a great deal when I was in high school. It was at a place where nobody was reading anything.
When you got going as a poet, were you conscious of joining a poet's conversation, so to speak, or taking your place in a network or a group or a school?
No, not at all. No, I was thinking of it as something I was sneaking into. I didn't feel I was part of any group, any kind of poetry even. I was just writing. I wrote a lot in college and sent much of it out, and it came right back. And nobody published anything. In fact, I decided when I was in college that the magazine I wanted to be in was Poetry Magazine, you know, Poetry Chicago. That was the one that got around. Everybody knew it. So I sent everything I wrote to Poetry, and it all came back. And I would write some more and send it, and it would come back. And then every once in a while, the editor would change. And I would regroup all the stuff I had sent before and send that. It all came back again. They disagreed on everything else except that they didn't want my poems. Something like 20 years later, I got a poem into Poetry Magazine when I no longer cared that much. My stuff was never immediately accepted anywhere or by anybody.
Keith Waldrop, place yourself historically as a poet in an American lineage, but then in terms of the times in this country that you write about even today?
Well, I remember our group in Ann Arbor, someone brought up the idea, which I don't agree with, actually, but they claimed that if you wanted to be an American poet, you had either to sort of align yourself with Whitman or with Emily Dickinson.
Hmm.
Now, I don't think you have to decide. I don't want to decide any such thing. But I must say, if I had to decide, I would be in the lineage of Dickinson. Everybody had always told me that her poems were odd, you know, that the meter was strange and all that. And I never found it that way. And at some point I realized why it was, why I think it was. And that is that she and I sang the same hymns.
Hmm.
And her structure is built on the kind of things that we sang.
What does it mean to be a celebrated American poet in the 21st century? What does your work reflect of the times we're living in now?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I remember all the time I've been writing poetry, I've heard people say, you know, it's too bad we don't have a sense of what poetry should do at this point. And I always thought that was great. I think, you know, that was, I would hate to have been told, this is what you should write. But now, in the 21st century, I keep thinking, is this going to happen now, or has it already happened and I haven't noticed? But I wonder if that is in fact something that will be obvious later. That, you know, in the 21st century, the big thing was, and maybe it hasn't yet appeared. You know, in the 20th century, it wasn't until 1910 or so that you got really the
It's modernism. An interesting question. Who would know if you don't know?
Well, I don't know that anybody knows, but we will eventually.
Among your fellow poets, where's American poetry heading?
I have no idea. I guess really when you get right down to it, I don't think of American poetry as a thing that could head somewhere. And I don't think the other poets whom I really like try to put themselves in a particular line with some other work or even with their own work.
Thank you, Keith Waldo, for your wonderful work, and congratulations on the prize, and thank you for this conversation.
You're quite welcome.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with the National Book Award winner Keith Waldo at the Watson Institute at Brown University. Our Brown interns, Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern, are helping us read up and think through this poetry series, Whose Words These Are. You can link to nearly a score of these conversations with poets so far. You can plug your own favorites for the next round at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.